Friends, if you have a copy of the scriptures, feel free to turn to Matthew chapter 12. We'll be there in just a second. And if you want to put a bookmarker in Genesis chapter 12, we'll spend a short bit of time there as well. We have been journeying through this teaching series called Next, asking the question, as the COVID restrictions had at least for the time and still had begun to be eased, as we reemerge, as we regather as a church, as we reconceive what it means to be a church on the other side of this pandemic, what's next for us? And we've said that we believe this is an intentional season of growth that we're meant to lean into. Growth for the glory of God. We don't want to grow just to gather people. We want the gospel to be announced to people and people to embrace it. We want God's glory to extend to the ends of the earth. But Jesus told us that the greatest way we can pursue the glory of God is by getting after the work that God has given us. Remember that prayer in John chapter 17? And so we've reflected on Jesus' call to us, the work he's given us, to make disciples. That means more and mature disciples. That as we, as individuals and as a church, lean into that, we are after the glory of God. And then over the last couple of weeks, we have acknowledged that to do that means we're going to have to be intentional. Right? As a church, we're going to have to be intentional about being engaged in what we're doing. We're going to have to be intentional about serving, serving in ways that are exciting to us and serving in ways that are less than exciting to us. And we're going to have to be people who are engaged in inviting, right? Inviting people to know who Jesus is, inviting people to connect to hope virtually or here in person. So there's a community of faith where they're connected to and helping us move towards the mission that God has given us. Today, what we want to talk about is perhaps the most important of all of them, because it is one of the chief commands that Jesus himself gives us. And that is, if we're going to lean into this reality of intentional growth, then we need to be a church that is filled with people who are loving, or what we'll call blessing this morning. We'll get to how to make sense of that. That is that we need to be people who are loving our neighbors well. If we're not doing that, then all of the other things, in essence, really are moot and perhaps even counterproductive. Jesus, in Mark chapter 12, was asked somewhat famously, and this is recorded in all the synoptic gospels. John doesn't record this exactly, but he talks about the concept of love an awful lot. In Mark chapter 12, Jesus was asked, what's the most important commandment? And Jesus answered, the most important one is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And that last word, that strength word, is the Hebrew word meod. And it really is an adverb that means very, right? With all your very. Like, there's this guttural, like, ugh, with everything that you have, right? And then he says, and the second one is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. Here it is, a commandment we've all heard, even if this is our first time in church. There's a sense that everyone knows that Christians, followers of Jesus, are called to be known by their love, John 13, 35, to love our neighbor as ourself. So let me pause and ask a question. Why is this so important for us? Why is it so important to be people who are known by our love for our neighbor? Now, let me suggest four things to you real briefly as we move through this. The first is that we have said in this series, and I deeply believe, that maturing disciples are people who increasingly obey everything Jesus commanded. Remember that from Matthew's, the Great Commission, where Jesus says, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded. So when we say, what is a disciple? We say someone who is increasingly obeying everything Jesus commanded. Well, If we're talking about the commandments of Jesus, first and foremost, right in front of us, in big letters, is this call to love God and to love our neighbor. If we're serious about following Jesus, then we have to be serious about loving our neighbor. In some sense, we ought need to go no farther than that, but it's important for us to dig just a little bit deeper. The second reason I think this is so important that we talk about loving our neighbor in this season is that Jesus seems to link the love we have for our neighbor pretty deeply to the love we have for God himself. He wraps those two together, in essence suggesting that a natural outgrowth of a love for God is a love for our neighbor. Why do I say that? Because if we are not people who are characterized by loving our neighbor, then that should be a red flag about our heart's affection for God himself. Does this make sense? Jesus says the second one is like it. There's this sense where the love for neighbor comes out of our love for God. Why is it so important? Because it is a telltale sign, a litmus test, as it were, of our heart's true affection for God himself. Third reason I think loving our neighbors is so significant is that the gospel was never meant to simply be a message or a proposition that was proclaimed or preached. It's meant to be a reality, a truth that is lived out, embodied. Does that mean we're not supposed to speak it? Of course not. Certainly we're supposed to speak it. But here's the truth of the matter. Largely, the gospel is at some level hard for people to comprehend. And that's not because people are not intelligent or not able to understand. It's because in many ways it's countercultural. When we talk about a God who would come to the earth, who would die for our sins, who in his resurrection has brought life to this world, that is cosmic. It's difficult for people to wrap their heads around. And increasingly in our world, in the West, in the United States, as people are increasingly what is called post-Christian, that is, they have little connection to the Christian faith in their upbringing or in their roots, this truth becomes more and more other or difficult to comprehend. It's understandable for people who've heard it time and time and time again. So why do I say all of that? Because when we love our neighbor, we are, in our actions, declaring that the gospel is true. And we are putting it on display for people that helps them get their head and their heart around what the gospel is and what it means, right? In the same way, you can read a Shakespeare play, but if it is put on for you, it makes a whole lot more sense, right? Or better yet, you can read a score of music, and perhaps you have little knowledge of notation and music, just like me, and it means nothing to you. You know there's some kind of song on there, but if people who know how to play that song get up and play it for you, there's beauty in that, and it captures your heart. The great missiologist Leslie Newbegin has said that the church is the sign and the foretaste of the coming and nearing kingdom of God. What does he mean by that? He means we're putting it on display for people to taste and touch and see. And he says, as they engage with it, they come with questions about this kingdom that we have answers for. Why is it so significant to love our neighbor? Because if we're just chirping about the gospel, it's going to connect with just a minute few, right? Fourth reason, and this is super practical for us in this particular season, that is, if we're talking about leaning into an intentional season of growth, of regathering, of reconnecting, of committing to the vision that God has given us as a church plan and a church moving forward, if we're talking about being a church characterized by everyone inviting, then we've got to have credible and meaningful relationships as the foundation for that. And so if we are not loving our neighbor, then we are simply resounding gongs, as Paul would say to the Corinthians, telling you should come to church or you should meet Jesus, and we're living a totally different way. So for those four reasons, today I want to suggest to you that chief amongst what God is calling us to in this season of our church and for the rest of the season of this church is to be people who are known by our love for our neighbor. The truth of the matter is, when we talk about this, it sounds nice, but when we think about it more deeply, it's overwhelming, isn't it? Because we look at the world around us, the first thing that we notate, because I hear it from you all the time, and I hear it from my own mind, is, you know how much stuff I have to do? And now I've got to love my neighbor too? I know I'm supposed to do it. I'm not trying to be a mean person or an evil person or anything like that, but my life is full. And yet, while that reality is true, maturing disciples are people who are increasingly obeying everything Jesus commanded. And we can't get away from his command to love our neighbors. So, important for us is to figure out then who is our neighbor. And of course, this is the classic question that is asked by one of the rulers who comes to Jesus in Luke chapter 10. And is asking Jesus, what do I have to do to inherit eternal life? And it's always a transactional reality for this man. He wants to be able to get it by his effort. And Jesus from Jump Street has figured this out and is going to reframe everything this man says throughout this whole time to say it's not about getting, it's about being. And the problem is we struggle to be. So Jesus says, well, what do you know? And what is the commandment? And he says, love God, love your neighbor. And then he says to Jesus, but who is my neighbor? Remember this? Because he wants to know. He says he wanted to justify himself. He wanted to be able to check the boxes. He wanted to be able to compartmentalize who his neighbor was so he could get it done and be on to other things. And Jesus, of course, tells the story of the Good Samaritan, which blows everything up for this man. And you remember the story. We won't take time to talk about it. But at the end of the story, Jesus changes the question from who is my neighbor to who was a good neighbor. And what Jesus is actually doing in this is reframing the question. In other words, not about who, but about what. What does it mean to be a good neighbor? We could take from the parable that a neighbor is really anyone with whom our life intersects, not just the people who live catty corner or right next to us, or the people whose cubicle is around us. Anyone whom our life naturally intersects with. But Jesus reminds us that this is not a checkbox, okay, my gosh, that means I've got thousands upon thousands of neighbors and I've got to do all these things for them. It's a culture. It's the kind of person we are called to be. We're called to be good neighbors, not to be able to check off who our neighbors are. Does this make sense? That it's a way of life, not a religious transaction. So, how do we do this then? In our spheres of influence, in all the people with whom our life naturally intersects with, how do we be people who build a culture of love for them with intentionality? We have said countless times together here at Hope that we believe that God has providentially placed us. You live where you live, you work where you work, you have the circles of friends that you have, your kids have the activities they have, not just because they're interesting to you, though they are, but because God has supernaturally intended for you to be there, to be a witness, an ambassador, an agent of love to your neighbors. So this becomes then less about adding to your routines, much more about living with intentionality in the things you're already doing. How do we do that? Well, maybe the best way we can do that is get to the root of Jesus' call to love our neighbor. And I think it's rooted all the way back in one of the very first stories of the Bible. Genesis chapter 12, Jesus, he's not around. Well, he's around, but he's not on earth at that moment. God calls a man named Abraham, and he says to Abraham, I'm going to make a great nation out of you, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. This is God's MO, right? This is the paradigm that God uses all throughout redemptive history. That is that when he gathers people, be it Abraham, be it the nation of Israel, be it Jesus, be it the church, be it the local church here in Bethlehem, he does it in order for the church to become a conduit of blessing to the world around us. That is that we do not hold on to the good things that God has done and become insular people only caring for ourselves. Rather, we dispense the grace that God gives us all around us. Now, in these two verses in Genesis chapter 12, there is one word that jumps off the page, correct? It's the word bless. I will bless you, you will bless others, I'll be a blessing to you, you'll be a blessing to others. This idea of blessing others becomes the reality, I think, of the law that calls us to love our neighbor and that Jesus pulls out along with loving God as the capstones of what it means to be a disciple. A pastor outside of Chicago named Dave Ferguson has written a book using this concept of bless to give a practical handle for us to know how to be intentional in loving our neighbor. He has taken the word bless and he has made an acronym out of it that gives us five simple things that we can do to regularly love our neighbor. These, to me, are life-changing. If we give ourselves to these things, if every day we try to engage in some of these things, we are being intentional about loving our neighbors. So let's walk through this. B stands for begin with prayer. We need to be people who are regularly praying for our neighbors. Praying for them generically because we don't know their name yet or we don't know their needs or we don't know what's going on in their life. But also praying for them specifically. That is, as we are getting to know them, understanding the struggles they're facing or the needs they have or their connection to God, praying with specifics for them. Listen, inherent in this reality of calling us to be people who pray for our neighbors is the reality that we ought to be people who are increasingly knowing our neighbors so that we can pray for them. Can I add something else to this? That part of praying for our neighbors is sometimes putting ourselves out there to ask them if we can pray for them. Now, this is a struggle for us sometimes, right? Because we don't want to be awkward and we don't know where people are at in their spiritual journeys. And yet, I have found way more often than not, people are incredibly receptive to an offer of prayer. And what an intentional move of love for them. Listen, oftentimes, if you're like me, your offer to pray for them means I'll do it later in private. But can I ask you something? Why not do it there in person, in that moment, and follow up with them later? We need to be people who are regularly praying for our neighbors. If part of your day is praying for your neighbors, can I say something? You are intentionally loving your neighbor. L stands for listen. And I want to pause and take some time on this because I'm really bad at this. And so maybe I'm only preaching to myself now and everyone else can just turn it off for the next 5 minutes, but there probably are a couple people who are just like me. In fact, the Apostle James tells us to be slow to speak and quick to listen. My guess is because we naturally aren't that way, right? Because he has to be corrective to us. That is that we are bent towards talking rather than listening. Now, I understand some people are introverts or some people don't want to be public, but just in natural relationships, we tend to be bent towards people who talk rather than listen. And yet, one of the chief ways that we learn to love God is by listening to God. Then wouldn't it also be true that one of the ways we lean towards loving our neighbor is listening to them as well? Now, Dietrich Bonhoeffer caught this well. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, of course, was a pastor famous during World War II. a resistor to Hitler and the Nazis, who ultimately lost his life because of it. But in that culture of opposition and oppression, he found the significance of community with local pastors and people like it. He wrote a super famous book called Life Together, really short, that you ought to really read because it's powerful stuff. But in that book, he talks a lot about listening. Look what he says. So he says, so it is his, that is God. It is God's work that we do for our brother when we learn to listen to him. Think about that for a moment. We are doing God's work when we listen to our brother. Christians, especially ministers, it goes after the pastors quick, so often think they must always contribute something when they are in the company of others, that this is the one service they have to render. They forget that listening can be a greater service than speaking. Isn't it so true? Somehow as Christians, that's cultured in us, that we've got to give them some kind of advice or point them towards some moment of theology or get ready to share our faith with them. And yet, perhaps the greatest thing we can do in that moment is give them our full attention and listen with incredible care. That when we listen, we actually do the work of God. Incredible stuff. One of the ways that we learn, that we intentionally lean into loving our neighbor is being people who regularly listen to our neighbors, to learn about them, to hear their stories, to see if there are needs, and to hear where God may already be at work. And a lot of that means not preparing to speak, just listening. I pause and say this, right? Because many people will think, well, I'm a good listener, but it doesn't feel like at the end of listening I've done anything. It's actually not true. Simply by providing yourself as a caring ear or someone interested in the life or the passions of another, you have extended a gospel reality to people in the same way that God extends him towards us and oftentimes listens to us babble about things that are of little importance. We too become agents of God when we listen. A couple of things I think are significant here. The first reality is that when we listen well, we affirm the humanity of another. For whatever reason, we are people who tend to want to affirm our value and our humanity and all of our relationships. And listening is a submissive posture. But when we do it, perhaps more than anything else we can do, we affirm and value another person. Think about this with me for a minute. What must it have been like in John chapter 4 for the woman at the well when Jesus came to her? And when he listened, was it not his ability to listen, perhaps, that opened her heart to the message he ultimately proclaimed? What must it have been like when Jesus came upon the short guy up in the tree named Zacchaeus and said, I want you to come over and listen to him, that ultimately led Zacchaeus to a radically different kind of lifestyle? When we pause and we listen, we affirm and value another person in a far more impactful way than we'll ever realize. Second thing I want to say is good listening seeks to understand without forming assumptions. Now listen, we live in the world of social media, so what I've just said is almost gone, right? It's almost not part of our culture anymore. Everyone has staked out their land, and we're in our defensive towers, and we're just looking for signs that you might be the enemy, right? And we've got all our pre-made defenses up. And yet, none of that is actual love to a neighbor. Loving our neighbor by listening seeks to understand them. Why they believe what they believe. What things in life have shaped their perspective. How I can learn from them without forming any assumptions about them. Listen to what the proverb says in Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 2. It says, "Fools find no pleasure in understanding. They delight in airing their own opinions." We probably should all just delete our Facebook account after reading that verse. You know. Fools find no pleasure in understanding. They delight in airing their own opinions. Think about it for a moment. If someone listened to you to understand you, how incredibly affirming that experience would feel. The third thing I think is true about good listening is that good listening prepares us to speak well if we are prompted. In my notes, in my outline I was writing up, I put "if" in capital letters, bold, italics, whatever, right? That is that you're not always have to speak. You're not just listening to prepare to speak. But if you're listening well, if the Spirit prompts you to speak, or if your spirit, in coordination with what they're saying, prompts you to speak, if you've listened to understand, if you've listened to care, it prepares you to speak well. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in the same context, said, "We need to have the ears of God so that we can have the words of God." Listening well prepares us to speak well if the Spirit prompts us. How do we love our neighbor intentionally? Take a posture of listening. The E in blessed stands for eat. Now I can get down with this, right? But, of course, it's not eating by yourself. The idea is eating with people, connecting with them over food or drink, or in a general sense, offering and receiving hospitality, connecting with people. There is something deeply biblical about sharing meals with people as a way of offering genuine embrace. This is why the Pharisees get so ticked off at Jesus when he tries to eat with people who they feel like he shouldn't affirm them. And by eating with them, he's affirming them. We get a cultural clue from that. There's something about sharing a meal with people that offers acceptance and that we ought to embrace. Now, we know this too, because when you share a meal with someone, or you grab coffee with someone, or share a drink with someone, or have people over to your home, something happens in that exchange, right? Guards are let down and bonds are formed. It just happens because stories are shared. And it becomes really significant. This does not mean that every night of the week you need to be opening your dinner table to other people, though that would be pretty stinking cool, wouldn't it? It does not mean that you have to schedule this stuff all of the time. It means it should be a regular part of your engagement with your neighbors, people that you are praying for and listening to. There comes opportunities when you can say, "Hey, let's have a cookout," or "Let's grab coffee," or "After the kids are in bed, let's sit out on the deck and have a drink together and get to know each other more." This is significant stuff, and Jesus shows us the way in this. First S in bless is to serve, right? What we're talking about here is meeting the real needs of people who our paths intersect with, small and big. When we serve another person, we provide a genuineness and a care for them that is incredibly impactful. And let me say the reverse is true here too. Part of being a good neighbor is letting your neighbors serve you. Because here's what I found. Again, maybe this isn't true, but here's what I seem to have found in the church is we get really good at serving people, but we don't like for people to serve us. And yet, that's not really a neighboring posture. It's not really a posture of love. It's more a posture of dispensing. Right? It's more a posture of superiority. That allowing yourself to be served by your neighbors and regularly serving your neighbors, whether they be neighbors at work, neighbors at home, neighbors in spheres of influence, is actually an incredible way of extending love towards them. And the last S in bless is story. Is that we are people who are regularly, when possible, sharing the story of Jesus with the people around us and the difference it has made for us. Again, it's significant and most impactful when we're able to do this with people who we have built intentional relationships with. Does it have to universally be that way? Of course not. God provides all kinds of opportunities that we should respond to. But we tend to have people who are open to this reality when we have taken the time to pray for them, listen to them, eat with them, and serve them. But let me say a couple of things about this, because this is the one that really starts to spook us. And you were thinking, I wonder if he was ever going to get to this, and I hope that he wasn't, but here we are, right? Let me say a couple of things about this, right? Here's what we're not talking about. We're not talking about an awkward, gospel, theological dump on somebody. Typically, that's not the most appropriate way to share the gospel with someone. At times, it may be, and you need to let the Spirit move. But let me suggest three things to you in terms of this neighboring reality. The first is, when we share the story of the gospel, the story of Jesus, so we should share it personally. Right? That is that... Here's what I have found, right? Almost in a come and see, could it be way, like we talked about last week. Like maybe you come across someone who is stuck in a situation or struggling in a situation, and it's a moment to share part of the truth of the gospel with them, the story of Jesus, but you share it personally as what you've discovered and how it has impacted you and how it has changed you. Right? We share personally. Not necessarily theologically. The second way, I think, is we need to learn to share the story in pieces, not always in one big dump, right? And that's deeply freeing even to my heart. I don't know if it is to you or not, but what that moment needs and calls for typically is a piece of the gospel, not the whole thing, because it will be overwhelming and hard to comprehend. And yet, each moment might provide new opportunities for new pieces that eventually get us to a place of being able to tie those ends together. We need to learn how to share the story of Jesus in pieces that make sense and that meet the moment. And then lastly, and let me say this as with as much conviction as I possibly can, we need to learn to share the story of Jesus positively. I mean this in a couple of ways. Right? The first is, what Jesus has done is good news. Right? It is not just, oh, God's angry and he's going to kill people, but thank goodness Jesus did this. Right? There's some truth in all that. We know that theologically. But listen, that's not the gospel. The gospel is who Jesus is, what he's doing. He's restoring the world. He's making a difference. And all of these, we need to learn how to share it positively. Not negatively. But secondly, what I mean by positively is we need to share it as if it's actually made a difference in our lives, not just as some abstract theological truth that we were trained to share at some points. And when we do that, 1 Peter chapter 3 reminds us, we need to do it with gentleness, with love, and with respect. Not shoving stuff down people's throats, not forcing people to listen to something they're not wanting to listen to, but speaking positively with respect, with gentleness, and with love. Here's the deal, church. If every single day on our bathroom mirror was a little card that said bless and had each of these things, perhaps it could redirect our mind to think, oh my goodness, loving my neighbor seems so esoteric and so big and so pervasive, and I could never do that. But we're reminded, oh, as I'm going, in the interactions that I'm already going to have today or the possibilities that I probably ought to step into, but I sometimes don't. What does it mean to love my neighbor? I'm going to bless them. I'm going to pray for them. I'm going to listen. When possible, I'm going to eat or have hospitality with them, serve them if I can. And where possible, I'm going to share the story of what Jesus is doing personally. I'm going to share it in pieces. I'm going to share it positively. And what you are then doing is being incredibly intentional about believing that God has providentially placed you where you are and called you to love your neighbor. Now imagine with me if we all committed to do this. Imperfectly, but committed to do this. That is, that if we were a church that was not just everyone engaged, not just everyone serving, not just everyone inviting, but also everyone blessing, the impact that the gospel could have and how this posture of blessing could enable a posture of inviting, of serving, and engaging. We believe that God has called us to an intentional season of growth. It's not because we want to get big or build buildings or anything like that. We want to see the gospel have the impact that we know it can have. And we want to see God's glory extend across this valley. But to do it, if we're going to do it, it means all of us, virtually, in person, those who aren't yet part of this, we have to be engaged. We have to believe in this mission. Not dragging our feet, but earnest after it. We have to be people who are willing to serve. Even if kids' ministry event on the 16th isn't our favorite thing, every once in a while, Nehemiah reminds us, we got to build a dung gate, right? Now listen, you can't build a dung gate at a kids' fall festival. We can't equate that. But setting up these drapes, that's a bit of a dung gate. Or the mess we've had trying to set up our new stream, which didn't work this morning, that felt like a dung gate this morning. But we need people serving because the mission is worth it. And we need people inviting. Increasingly, people are open to an invitation in Jesus and an invitation to a church on the basis of meaningful relationships. A come and see invitation that says, check it out. See if it's a place where you could connect, a place where you could be part of something significant, a place where you could have the questions that you have answered. And perhaps most importantly, if we're going to lean into this, we need to be a church where everyone is blessing, loving our neighbor with intentionality. So remember when I said, imagine if you had a little card that was stuck on your bathroom mirror? Guess what I have for you? A little card that you can stick on your bathroom mirror or in your wallet or on your desk at work or wherever it might be that has this simple acronym to constantly remind you of ways to lean into regularly loving your neighbor. We'll have those for you as you leave this morning. But now let me pray with you.